That and also when the kombucha place stayed open during Stagecoach.
Oh.
Also rather funny. Kambu, what?
What's wrong with this, Jim?
Greetings and welcome to the first edition of Left Reckoning's bi-monthly news crossover with us here at This Is Revolution. We've done cross streams with the Left Reckoning fellows before, but we decided it is always so much fun and informative that we needed to make it a regular occurrence. Please note that there are links in the description for those of you who are new to each channel, so please subscribe. If you're unfamiliar with Matt and David, subscribe to their channel, Left Reckoning. Additionally, if you feel inclined and have the means, please consider becoming a patron. Both of us offer exclusive content to our patrons, and this helps us remain independent and, more importantly, prevents us from selling out. Speaking of selling out, Matt and David, as well as us here at TIR, have new merchandise available. Let's check out the Left Reckoning guy stuff. Let's look at this. Look at that hat. Look at that guy modeling that hat. I'm actually going to get the hat. Not lying. I'm going to get a Left Reckoning hat. But I also want the shirt with Bernie and Willie Nelson on it. Because of the look on people's faces when I walk around with two old white men like that on my shirt, it's going to really fuck with it. So, that is the Left Reckoning merchandise. Also, we have new merchandise here at This Is Revolution. Let me pull that up. We here at This Is Revolution, the TIR committee, as we'd like to be called, the brain trust, if you will. M. Toussaint is also in this new This Is Revolution merchandise. Bam! We got mugs, people. This is not the exclusive mug that you get for being a patron. That's a very different mug. But we have the TIR Central Committee mouse pad. You cannot see M. Toussaint because also on here, she is the faceless, headless voice of reason. So let's bring in the TIR and Left Reckoning crew. Together, we form a revolutionary reckoning. So let me bring in, first and foremost, my homie, my dog, my co-host. He is the Captain America to my Iron Man. He is the Pascal Robert.
I'm Captain America to your Iron Man. Really?
I told you, we're going to have different ones each time. You're never going
to
know.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings.
You're going
to
be the Pamela to my Tommy Lee. There's so
easy,
much.
Whoa, easy.
You don't ever think that you are going to know what I'm going to hit you with whenever we are united on the screen. Are you ready for the show tonight?
I'm ready to rock and roll.
Well, let's bring in our Left Reckoning comrades. Coming all the way live from a bunker somewhere in Austin. I shouldn't say a bunker. From the pictures he puts on social media, it's more like a Texas chainsaw house. Please welcome David Griska.
Happy to be here, y'all. How y'all doing?
I'm still trying to figure out the scary picture you put. You just posted a picture of, like, this is where I chased the victims.
It's a beautiful. I had a beautiful afternoon walk, and I wanted to share with our friends. And
oh, that's what
Jason's
they call it
mind
now.
Immediately went to darker things.
Hey, look, I can go on with my Texas in the middle of nowhere stories, and in the champagne room, I'll make sure I tell the story of the first time I was ever in. Was it either Tomball, Texas, or Humble, Texas? There's a Tomball, Texas, right?
Maybe. There's a lot of towns.
It was a little town, and a lot of weird stuff happened there that I've never seen before and seen since. And I will always think of Texas after that trip. But I will tell that story when you're not here. I won't make fun of you, but I will make fun of where you're from.
People should definitely be checking that out.
My favorite North Dakotan. Yes, I'm thinking about it. No, he is by far my favorite North Dakotan. He is the Batman to David's Robin. He says that's okay. He is Matt Leck.
I don't want to be Batman. David should be Batman.
That's you don't too want much to be the reluctant Batman?
No, I don't like that. I want to be. I don't know what Robin's backstory is, but a lot less pressure, I think, than Batman.
There's multiple Robins, so you can pick which Robin who you think best symbolizes you. You could be Dick Grayson Robin. Hmm. Right? That's a good one.
Yeah. Wasn't he a gymnast?
Yes, he's a gymnast. What? Yes, gymnast.
While his family was circus people.
Yes. Yeah. And that's very similar to Matt's life. In the
yeah, exactly. That's exactly like my upbringing in North Dakota.
Nailed it.
And that voice you hear, that lovely voice you hear, which you never get to hear, she is moderator extraordinaire. But here, she's a very important part of the... She's a cog in the machine that makes This Is Revolution go. The M2 song...
I graduated to being a cog.
Yes, you're an important cog.
Much appreciated. Hello, Matt. I am also your mod. Not for left reckoning, though.
Yeah, underappreciated, M. Toussaint. Thank you so much for your service on the Majority Report boards.
That's so nice. Thank you.
I thought Sam's going to give a shout out to his mods.
Put in a request for the raise now.
Just ask for a mug. Be like, can I at least get the goddamn mug?
That'd be cool, actually.
Hey, I email the show, I think, is probably the best way to do that. No.
Oh, God.
I don't want to. The problem is, like, we could definitely hook you up, but I don't want to commit to any administrative stuff that I have trouble falling through on. So, but we can get you a mug somehow, I'm sure.
All right.
Well, I do want to remind everyone that. After we're finished here, we'll be heading to our patron-only champagne room, where we'll be joined by our good friend and journalist for a Latin American rundown, Camilo Gomez. In order to take part in this conversation, please go to patreon.com/BitterLakePresents. You will also find links in the description as well in the chat. Now that we have that out of the way, David Griscom.
Yes, sir.
You want to discuss Lee Phillips' latest piece in the New Statesman. I can't even talk right now. Statesman.
I sure
and
do.
I popped a little bit of my original writing of it as I was making last-minute edits. Talking about the environment and capitalism and socialism. And if we lived in a socialist paradise, would we still have these problems with the environment? We all understand that capitalism extracts and destroys the environment. It's kind of inherent in the system.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious what y'all think about this. Maybe to like set the stage, I can give it a quick sense of what his argument is here. One, I highly suggest reading the piece because it's a fascinating one. And, you know, Lee Phillips is a good friend of ours at Left Reckoning, somebody you should definitely be following and listening to. But he wrote this piece in the New Statesman called Would There Still Have Been Climate Change Under Socialism? And he makes an interesting argument here where he says, contrary to what I think a lot of people might on the left sort of reflexively say, which would be no, he says, yeah, there definitely would have been climate change under socialism, but the reasons as to why are really important. So just to quote a little bit from the piece, he sort of sets up a counterfactual, like let's imagine that the German Social Democratic Party doesn't completely collapse into reformism and then joining up with the state in the imperial war of World War One. He sort of sets up an alternative timeline where basically global socialism wins out in the 30s and tries to imagine what that history would look like. So, you know, we're coming here from like optimal historical conditions. But let me just read a little bit from the piece here. He says, so in a socialist 20th century, up until the 1980s, fossil fuel extraction and combustion, steel, cement, and fertilizer production, rice, beef, and dairy and agriculture and aviation, trucking and shipping, all would have had continued in essentially the same fashion as happened in history, but there would have been much, much, much more of it, as so many billions of people would have access to industrial modernity. And all this progress would have unfolded with society largely unaware of the consequences for the climate. Exploitation would have come to an end and poor working conditions with them. And economic development would have occurred in an egalitarian fashion rather than being driven by profit and colonial inter-imperialist necessity. But it is hard to believe that, for example, socialist steel foundries would have used a different chemical reaction to turn iron oxide into iron than capitalist societies did. To say that socialism would have been able to avoid a climate-changing volume of greenhouse gases is thus to suggest that eco-socialism would not have delivered electricity, transport, modern housing, and so on to all, which would not have been a socialism that any 20th century Marxist would have recognized. And I think that this is a really interesting argument. I understand why some people might be a little bit hesitant to embrace this. But effectively, what he's arguing here is that, you know, socialism is a system that is designed to meet human needs. And unlike the development that we saw in the 20th century, where so many of the benefits of industrialization, of modernization of economies went mainly to the capitalist class and also were sort of isolated in, you know, Western Europe and North America, and you had purposeful underdevelopment of like the third world, for example, that these things would have been, we would have been using these technologies to meet social need at that time. He doesn't argue, however, that a social system would not be better equipped to deal with climate change. And quoting again from the piece, and I'm going to be really curious to hear what y'all think about this. I would just set it up. The difference between capitalism and socialism with respect to climate change or any other environmental problem is that under the latter, any ecological threat from a technology is discovered. The main barrier to switching away from that technology is the speed with which scientists and engineers can develop alternative technologies that don't cause the identified harm while still delivering the same benefit. So the point here is that once you recognize that this is a crisis, when scientists and people who are running that society under planned economy recognize that this is a threat to global civilization, they would be much faster at sort of dealing with that. But I think it's a really important point and a challenge as we're trying to find ways out of the crisis that we're in, is that, you know, recognizing that it's not necessarily that capitalism and socialism wouldn't have been using, for example, fossil fuels to power their societies. But the way that the proceeds and the benefits were sort of delivered would be vastly different. And undoubtedly, like the working conditions would have been very, very different. And it's just important because so many of, I think, some of these environmental movements that we're seeing right now in the U.S. And in Europe in particular, really deny this kind of fundamental aspect of socialism. Like, remember, like, what did Lenin say communism was? I don't know if y'all know this quote. It's a very famous quote. Communism is electrification and Soviet power. And it's trying to like reconnect the like Marxist promise, the socialist promise of delivering for people with like these current movements that we're building. And I think that a lot of times this has sort of been lost as we've sort of fallen into some of these pessimistic philosophies that don't see the end goal of our transformation actually meeting people's needs and expanding upon them and living lives of abundance, which is always what socialism promised. And that's the real challenge that we have to find a way to construct that under very, very unfortunate and difficult circumstances today. But anyways, I'm curious what y'all think about the piece and the argument here, because I think it's a really important one and an interesting one nonetheless.
Yeah, I think for me, I think that it's a foregone conclusion that there still would have been climate damage done under socialism, because particularly if we're taking the Marxian analysis of capitalism, Marx's remedies for capitalism are still rooted in the reality of industrial development. And much of his analysis is rooted in trying to create a workspace within the paradigm of industrial development that is more humane, that eventually leads to communism. But that still eventual move is a process within the realization that industrialization is already developed. Another question I would ask is that how much of the industrialized affection socialism has, in other words, the fetish for industrial development, comes from the fact that the largest socialist project we had in the world comes out of a feudalist system and is trying to improve itself to compete with the rest of the already industrialized world. In other words, the fact that the Soviet Union before the Russian Revolution is literally a feudal backwater giant ice barge and has to, under Stalin, find a way to modernize itself in 5 years, how much does that process lead to an almost kind of fetishized view of industrialization that becomes part of the psyche of the left or the socialist left overall?
No, I mean, I think that that's an interesting point. And I would also add that, like, one of the things that's important about the argument that Lee Phillips is making here too is it's one that there's a contemporary side to it, where, you know, one of the things that we have to talk about when we're talking about any kind of green transition is, well, what do we do for parts of the world that are underdeveloped? Right, where like they were purposefully did not go through that period because capitalism tried to keep parts of the world poor and underdeveloped, and you have to have a solution for the billions of people who don't sort of live in like fully industrialized economies, for them to have a way to industrialize and improve production in their societies so that they can be producing more food and goods and services that people need to survive.
Well, a question I want to ask you is that I'm not an anti-modernist, one of the things I noticed with environmentalists and the environmental movement is that there's this kind of admiration of like, oh, let's get back to nature. And I'm not one of these people who believes that like we all go live in the forest and everything is okay and everything is beautiful. Like, there is a benefit to modernity.
A huge one. I think
quality health care, treatment for illness. There has been a consequence, but I think that the key for me is that we have to find a balance. And I think that this notion that either a zero-sum game of one or the other is a problem. I think that definitely we don't want to deny developing countries the road to industrial development where they can actually make and manufacture products and become part of some kind of economic system. Are we going to tell them that they need to go back to the days where they were like, you know, living in pre-industrial ages, where they can deal with all kinds of the illnesses and diseases that come from that as well? I mean, that's a bargain I don't think they'd be willing to accept. So how do we balance that?
I mean, I'd be curious to hear other folks' thoughts, but just like off the top of my head, I think like the big point that I know Phillips makes and I try to make as well is that there is plenty of potential for, you know, green industrial growth. That's like what the Green New Deal promise was, particularly like the Green New Deal promise on the global scale, which I think was some of the better parts of the Bernie Sanders argument, is that we can be increasing productivity. We can be increasing investment. But yeah, we have to use different kinds of technologies. And the challenge that we have in front of us, you know, is in a lot of ways the opposite of like the we don't have the same tool that, you know, Phillips sort of lays out in this kind of alternative history where like socialism becomes dominant, where we have democratically controlled planned economies so that we can move quickly and fast with state investment to meet people's needs without having to over rely on things like fossil fuels to do that.
we talked about this a little bit Tuesday, that how small the U.S. government was before the New Deal. So if this would magical thing would take place before the New Deal, we're talking about having a much smaller federal government. That, you know, the FHA is a big reason why we have certain problems with the environment, because we start building out and creating the suburbs with the mass production of housing. Do we not have that level of mass production of housing and things like automobiles? What happens with the idea of commercial flight at this point? What even happens with the idea about interconnecting us with the highway initiative? I'm just asking questions here, because this whole thing is me thinking about some of the things that we have gotten post the 30s because of this kind of Fordist production, a need to save capitalism, but with some sort of democratic social policies.
Can we have modernity without consumerism?
I don't think so.
Depending on what we mean by consumerism, I mean, I think that this is where, you know, I might, you know, annoy some folks that I think that there is this kind of leftist anti-reaction to industry, because industry has been controlled by private hands for so long. Mm-hmm. But you got to remember, for example, in successful socialist systems, that was the big promise. Right. And even Cuba, which is a historic example of people surviving an onslaught of, of imperialism through the continued blockades and embargo. You know, so people oftentimes look at us look at how resourceful the Cuban government is. And I think undoubtedly there's a lot of inspiration that we should be drawing from that example, particularly the inspiration that happens when you do have a planned economy, your ability to sort of orient the materials that you have towards social good. But I'll tell you this right now, if Cuba wasn't blockaded and under, effectively imperial warfare for the past 50, 60 years, I think that you would see a much, much more modern and robust society in Cuba, right? This is not a choice that was sort of made in the sense of them saying these are our values. It was saying, we're going to survive this attack from the big devil, the Americans, and we're going to use whatever we can to be able to do that in a world where they're not in conflict. I think 100% some of the kind of things that we think about, for example, really, really old cars and things like that, would not actually be as endemic in Cuba as they are currently. And and one last thing on the airfare, I think it's wonderful that we can be an interconnected society and that people can go around and travel. And the fact is that because the main goal of airline companies is profit, there is no real intention or interest in innovation of using different kinds of fuels to power plants, and these are the kinds of things that with state investment, state direction, that those are the problems that we can be tackling and addressing. So it's not that flying's good, as a concept, do we want people to be able to go around the world? I would like that in any kind of future I want to live in.
I wish you were old enough to remember what flying was like before.
hot air balloons.
Wasn't it better? Nicer?
It was way better. He had more room.
9/11 really jacked up the whole
thing. If you're Pascal's age, Pascal remembers when planes had fireplaces.
I remember when they gave you food, a meal, chicken. You make a real meal.
I'm not even trying to be funny. If you think I'm bullshitting, look up airlines before the deregulation. And they had to compete with driving. Driving was a very comfortable thing for America, and the train. So planes, there were stairs on them bitches.
That's back when people used to dress up to take.
People used to dress up to get on a plane. Hey, put on your good clothes to get on a plane. Yeah. A plane?
I prefer sweatpants. I gotta say, maybe that's a trade-off I'm willing to
make. But what's your take, man? We've
full,
left you
full slob luxury communism under Matt.
Absolutely, yeah. I have sweatpants that are just for airplanes. Yeah, I mean, I think what I like about Lee's stuff is it is provocative in the way I think there's certain and shakes up the environmental discourse. So not only like the degrowth stuff, which like I think does make people think about things like air travel and like, okay, let's just get rid of that. It's like, well, what do you mean let's like you get to the front of a political movement and then you decide to make that the priority and then like your political movement's dead. I think, right? And instead, it should be thinking, like, who's profiting off of all of this, like, air travel? Who owns that stuff? And also the sort of apolitical utopianism, as if, like, I think this is an important thought experiment, and I think Lee says it himself, like, socialism wouldn't just mean, like, the end of problems and things to, like, negotiate politically. The end of politics is... these things are going to take a lot of negotiation. And I mean, that's, I guess, how that eventually looks with countries that are developing and need to develop capacities that we were able to just be as dirty as hell for 100 years developing. I mean, that's the question.
We have a super chat from Ben Burgess. He says, hey, it's Matt and David on TIR. Good stuff. I just want you to know that I bought that off of him because I told him he's coming down here and we're actually going to do a show on my terrace.
Oh, hell, I told him,
Ben, if you come down here and do a show on the terrace, I will buy a liquor.
You're going to buy a liquor?
That's a cheap buy a liquor. That,
man, I got to say.
So Ben will be good and liquored up when he's on the show.
Shout out to Dr. Osgood as well. He's in the chat.
Oh, it's an all-star extravaganza.
Everyone's already. Dr. Oz is in here too.
Dr. Oz. We can't call him Dr. Oz.
Yep.
Can't do that, Pastor.
That's right. We can't do that anymore.
We can't call him Dr. Oz. Now let's. We have a limited amount of time with the Left Reckoning guys, so I want to make sure I get everybody's story in here. Pascal, you sent me something that was a bit shocking to read. Is it true that governors in more conservative states are sending undocumented citizens to more liberal blue states? What is the purpose of this?
Well, in the wonderful political climate that we have right now, it seems like the creativity of the reactionary right-wing governors in two states, particularly Arizona and Texas, in light of the increased migrant crisis that we've had since the advent of the Biden presidency, there's been a very creative way that they've decided to show the administrators of our government in Washington, D.C., that there's a problem with the increased wave of migrants. And the way they've done that is to actually pay private buses to ship migrants, initially largely to D.C., but now to D.C. and New York City. That is correct. Governors like Greg Abbott of Texas and Ducey of Arizona have decided that in order to show the libs in the blue states how problematic their influences are in terms of immigration and how much the cost is outweighing the red states, that they're going to actually pay. And I did the research. I found that in Arizona, the buses cost $80,000 per bus.
What kind of buses are they in? Are they in those tech buses where there's like Wi-Fi inside and good AC?
I don't know, but it must be some really nice buses. But the costs are immense, and they're doing it because they want to send an example to particularly Washington to let them know that this is what your quote-unquote immigration policy is costing us. What is fascinating is that this conflict has been going on for over 3 months now, has been so bad that it's causing a kind of tete-a-tete verbal beef between the mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, and Greg Abbott, governor of Texas, in that now Eric Adams has promised to send a convoy of New York City residents to Texas to campaign against Greg Abbott in his own election. So now we have a mutual a threat of actually New Yorkers being shuttled down to Texas to campaign against Greg Abbott for his constantly importing migrants who are in Texas now to New York City. Now,
okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Now, what is really fascinating about all of this to me is that it's really kind of cruel the way in which these reactionary governors are able to play with the lives of these migrants who are asylum seekers. and just basically dispatched them and said, well, we're just going to, I mean, apparently it's true that the people are, they're volunteers. They don't take people who are, you know, against their will. So they asked them, would you like to go to New York? Would you like to go to D.C.? And then they shipped them along. But it's a really, it demonstrates to me how much the reactionary right likes to play a kind of circus Olympics type politics in which spectacle is used as a means to get their point across to just for the sake of shaming the libs. Texas is your state. I'd like to hear what your thoughts are.
Well, I think Matt has something good first.
I mean, I just find it amazing that it's basically like both of these folks have decided that, like, to make people the weapon. Like, if you look at the where the phrase the mob comes, it's from, like, you know, the 1600, like, 1700s, like, you're British aristocrats, and the full term was the mobile vulgus, which is just, like, you know, a whole bunch of people that can move with you. So they're literally sending, okay, we'll send you some undocumented people, and we'll, and tit for tat, we'll send you some people to campaign. I mean, what are those? I mean, David can comment on how much impact those a busload of people.
Of I don't America think that would be very helpful if I'm being completely honest.
But also, what's the definition of, like, human trafficking? I'm just thinking about, like, the way. The way that the Republicans always talk about that, and also, like, caravans full of people to come in and vote, and then it's literally just like, I mean, the projection, I guess, is where I'm going to end up on that. Just wild that I thought we were the ones that are supposed to be organizing caravans.
So I totally agree that it's really disgusting to use, like, human beings as spectacle like that. I will say, ironically, like, some of the interviews that have been done with people who have been on these bus systems have been like, thank you very much. Like, you know, my family's in Virginia or wherever. So I was able to get there a little bit easier than I had originally planned. I mean, like, I don't want to take away from the seriousness of it, because I do totally agree that it's extremely nasty. The thing that's wild about it is, like, I mean, like, here's the political reality. I mean, why is Abbott doing this? He's doing it to get on Fox News and get Bubba's in Tennessee excited for his potential run for president in 2024, which he's losing at badly. And Abbott has become, like, a real political stuntman. Not only doing this, he shut down trade with Mexico for about a week, cost the state and the nation billions of dollars. Food was rotting on trucks, but he legally couldn't do very much. All they were doing was inspecting tires on tractor trailers and stuff like that, and sending people along their way. It was just slowing things down for the spectacle of being like, Abbott stands strong on the border. The craziest thing about it is Abbott ran for is running for governor, and he had to go through a Republican primary that was, like, extremely far right. And he was challenged almost exclusively from the far right of the Republican Party here. And one, Don Huffines, one of the guys he ran against, ran on this idea of shutting down trade with Mexico, which is absolutely insane. Texas is very much reliant on that. And everybody laughed at him, including Abbott. And then Abbott started incorporating his policies. But on the busing in particular, the real irony here is the far right people are getting really mad about it because of taxpayer money is being spent on the stunt, and they're worried about the cost to the state government here.
How much is this going to cost?
I actually don't know how successful it as a stunt, like, just being neutral, even dropping morality as a stunt, how effective it really even is for Abbott at this point. It's certainly a crazy story.
What are the chances? Because I was watching a video of my least favorite Democrat, Beto O'Rourke. I mean, what are the chances?
Oh, by the way, you know, you loved when he cursed that guy out.
Beto, I mean, like, how many bad Bobby Kennedy impressions is this guy going to do before he realizes that he needs to just drop that, man? I mean, like, oh my God, he just exudes so much, like, bad wannabe Kennedy personality. It's kind of ridiculous. But, like, you know, does he have a shot at all or what?
That dude's on the other side of the world for you. He's in El Paso, isn't he?
Yeah, but he's everywhere. I mean, he's like a couple things I will say that, like, I do like Beto's, or we should call him by his name, Robert O'Rourke. strategy of saying, I'm going to campaign in every county. I actually think that that's a decent strategy that Democrats should start embracing, instead of saying, like, we're going to ignore parts of the state that we think are too conservative for us. I mean, like, really, if I'm being neutral about this, just being a little political analyst, right, which I don't do very often, what's really going to end up mattering, and I know it's hard to talk about things like this, but it's like, how salient will Uvalde and abortion rights feel to people in November? Because he's got an uptick in the polls since both of those things have happened, but it's a long campaign season, and you know, is he going to be able to continue to ride that? I haven't seen much from Beto to like sort of make me feel confident saying that I think he even really has like a shot for it to be close, because it's a very different campaign from his original Senate campaign, and which was you know, was Democrat liberal squishy stuff, but it was pretty decent. You know, it felt like it was an influx of new energy. But I can't express to people how much goodwill he lost here when he ran for president in 2020. People really, really did not like that move. Now, the Democrats, like, you know, reliable Democratic voters, no problem. They love Beto. They'll be with him. But those people on the margins who he sort of brought in, I think that betrayed a kind of, you know, political calculating aspect of himself that I think is a bit of a turnoff. But, I mean, we'll have to see. I mean, Abbott's done bullshit on the grid, which was a real issue that affected folks' lives. I was talking about earlier today. He's now illegally, effectively, because he doesn't have the legal authority to do this, pressuring ERCOT, which manages the system here, to select a candidate to be CEO that he wants, which is not his job, right? He's like just taking that onto himself. So I'd like to see a little bit more pressure on that. I know Beto, every time he goes out and speaks, is that we're going to fix the grid. But like materially doing a bit more on that to like really motivate people, I haven't seen enough.
I don't know if you guys watched this documentary called Wild, Wild Country, I believe. And it's
Is that the cult thing?
Yeah, it's a religious cult in Oregon. I want to say they were in Eastern Oregon. And there was like they were fighting for this land. And it got to the point where they were like, you know what? We're tired of dealing with the city council, so we're going to vote the city council people out and get our own person elected. And so they went and got these buses, and they started picking up homeless people all over, like, the East Coast, like D.C. and New York. And they brought them to this massive commune. Like, look, you're living on the streets. Come here and be a part of our community, and if you stay here for so long, you'll be a resident and you can vote. And they found that when everything was all over, that a lot of the homeless people didn't want to go back. Give them a little bit of a problem for them. But it is funny to see, you know, these people in this bus shit, because literally it's something that has happened before. I don't know how many instances in history there have been where people have actually gathered other cats to try to either flip an election or do something like this. Like, we'll show you how much we can't stand these people. Because I remember in the South, they cracked down. Do you remember this, Toussaint? A few years ago, they cracked down in the South on migrant workers. And they were going to replace them with incarcerated labor. And it just went so horribly that they were begging to get the people back that they had deported. Do you remember that, Toussaint?
No, I don't actually. But I will say, maybe we won't be happy about this, but it reminds me of the boat lift. Was it the Mariella?
Oh, in the 80s?
Yeah.
In the 80s, there was the Cubans.
Yeah, Pascal was there.
I was not there. I was not
He was waving to me when he had a Haitian flag. He was like,
no,
sorry. Only the dark Cubans.
That's actually not correct. That is
what do you mean?
That is a racism.
Maybe it is. But just know this, Pascal.
We're coming for you, nigga.
God.
I saw the Hulk Hogan clip that actually was taken.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty funny.
Did you fall out laughing when you watched it?
I did. I was like, oh, this is hilarious. He's actually talking to Hulk Hogan like this. I was like, this is kind of funny.
Because when he says it, he goes, oh, shit.
He knew right afterwards, like, I shouldn't have said that.
He was like, my whole career.
Melted in one afternoon.
some people are making more drops. You guys want more drops? No.
More drops.
Oh, also, if you guys are new listeners or new viewers to the show from Left Reckoning, I won't put this on Pascal. I have a soundboard where I have set up several drops that are inside jokes. One of them is that one from the famous wrestler Booker T calling out Hulk Hogan. And another one is from our favorite movie called Fly By Night, where a rapper says a rap line I've never heard in my life, that we would be surprised how many people love the crack. About how addictive crack is. You'd be surprised how many people love it.
Even Pusha T never says that. He's been doing crack rap for like 20 years or something.
So now you guys know those two things. I'm sure people are watching like, what the fuck did that guy just say?
Yep. Just be prepared as you come by, come on every now and then, bi-weekly for our roundup. Be prepared for Jason to find all kinds of new sounds to use. By the way, I was not a big fan of the soundboard. I've adjusted to liking the soundboard. That doesn't mean great. I like the sounds that Jason puts on the soundboard. What is Tristan's sound? The occasional then, laugh. Then you want
so we have this special set. We have to get a special patch for Matt and David that is more
white boy friendly. That would work for white boy friendly.
Yes. We have this.
Eat a bowl of fuck.
That's one of them.
Who is that?
The Dave Cook. That?
That's from a movie called Night of the Demons.
Of course it is. Of course it is. We have.
I heard that line. Chats. I heard that line in the movie. I was like, "Who says that?" Like, no one says
I re-listened to like Dane Cook stand up that I haven't listened to since like high school, and it's wild. It's wild, like the low effort that made
his. It's really low effort, man.
Crazy at the time. It's like, you guys ever seen bees? I'd punch a bee in the face. It's just that's all he's saying, and people are just. I at the time thought it was fucking hilarious.
Well, you know, just remember there was a world where Daniel Tosh was one of the top comedians.
You know, I'm ashamed to say it. Daniel Tosh I've seen twice.
Live?
Live.
That's amazing.
Even sorry to say that the second time it was a lot of the same jokes as the first time.
Oh, man.
Hey, David, you know why that is? You'd be surprised how many people love the crack.
Allegedly.
Oh, shit.
Allegedly.
Yeah. I saw Tim Heidecker the other day. Do y'all know Tim Heidecker?
Yeah,
from Twitter.
Yeah, he did the live show here in Austin. It was pretty fun. He smashed up his fucking microphone. Like the whole thing was that he was like angry at he just did like this bizarre stand up routine for like 20 minutes, and like basically the whole time it was just him fighting with the venue for like them not accommodating him enough or doing enough shit for him, and he just smashed his fucking microphone up on stage. Wow. It was pretty wild.
Daniel Tosh made fun of people that were silly on the internet before Twitter was famous for making fun of people being silly on the internet.
Fair enough.
Let's remember that. He was trolling and an internet bully.
Yeah, he said, look at this weirdo and put it on cable.
Yeah. Look how dumb this guy is.
I mean,
made a fucking living off that.
That's what the internet was like 2010. It was like, hey, we found this guy's YouTube page and he does stand up in his backyard. Let's like laugh at that. And that guy ended up on Tosh too. His name was Daniel Songer. But for years, it was just a guy that me and my friends knew, and like only like 100 people watched his stuff. And then like, season 18 of Tosh.0 had him in for like a web redemption or whatever the fuck.
The web redemption is the only reason I watched Tosh.0. Web redemption was the Star Wars kid, the Tron guy. Let's be honest, man. The world was very different 10 years ago.
Yep.
Very true.
Just 10 years.
No, it's amazing actually to watch something from like the 2010s.
I just watched that movie. What's the disaster movie with all those comedians that can't Seth Rogen.
Oh, Greg, yeah.
This is the end.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but I know what you're talking about.
I laughed really hard, and then I went, you can't make this movie.
Oh, yeah.
You can't make this movie. I won't even talk about what I saw on the screen, because anything I would say would definitely get me canceled.
Or, like, I remember I tried to watch The League again. I don't know if you ever watched that. It was, like, a funny – it was a fantasy football sitcom. Yep. Very funny show, but, like, holy shit. Sometimes you watch it, you're like, that was, like, 7 years ago, man. And, like, they – that could not exist today either. It's wild how quickly things move, I guess, for the best.
And that's probably why Joe Rogan still exists, like, if you want to know. There's a bunch of people that are sitting here going, man, I want to make gay jokes again. And then
you just turn on Joe Rogan. Oh, yeah. Tropic Thunder is another one.
Oh, my. Yeah, you can't do that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, Lord. Before we go too far down the rabbit hole of silliness, Matt, you wanted to discuss crying CEOs.
Yeah, so this is a pattern I've been observing as, you know, CEOs are firing people more and more, and then going to social media and thinking like a sort of personal essay is going to make things feel better for everybody as opposed to themselves. So there's a story, CEO of Hypersocial, which specializes in services like optimizing LinkedIn posts, which I also want to say, yeah, like for anybody out there who's having to optimize their LinkedIn, I feel for you. I know how dark that is. I thank God I haven't been there in like 5 years. But that shit sucks. The entire like way this economy is structured, where you have to debase yourself on these platforms and sort of like put your personal experience into different sort of like boxes. And send it to like recruiting agencies, stuff like that. It's the worst, most dehumanizing thing I've been through, and I think it should all go up in flames. But anyway, so this guy expanded a little bit his LinkedIn optimization business too much, and he posted this. His name is Braden Wallachy, and I'll just share here.
Share the screen.
And it starts. This will be the most vulnerable thing I'll ever share. And
almost, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then bam, dick pic.
I've gone back and forth about whether to post this or not. We just had to lay off a few of our employees. I've seen a lot of layoffs over the last few weeks on LinkedIn. Most of them are due to the economy or whatever reason. Ours, my fault. I made a decision in February and stuck with that decision for far too long. Now I know my team will say we made that decision. What a great team he's got, the ones that are still there. But I led us into it. And because of those failings, I had to do today the toughest thing I ever had to do.
Resign.
yeah, we don't need the soundboard for that one. we've always been a people-first business, and we always will be. Except for those people that were about to fire. Days like today, I wish I was a business owner that was only money driven and didn't care about who we hurt along the way. But I am not. So I just want people to see that not every CEO out there is cold hearted and doesn't care when he/she have to lay people off. I'm sure there are hundreds and thousands of others like me. The ones you don't see talked about because they didn't lay off 50 or 500 or 5,000 employees. They laid off one, two, or three. One, two, or three that would still be here if better decisions had been made. I mean, who was making these decisions? I think like it's chief executive officer. I'm not a businessman myself. I know it isn't professional to tell my employees that I love them. From the bottom of my heart, I know how much I do. Every single one, their families, hubs. I'm going to just skip. And then he includes.
Oh, got to
have. Oh, my gosh.
It would have been better, though. At that point.
Would have been more professional.
Yeah, dick pic would have been more respectable
if you just and that would be something. Like, yeah, that's where we know the sort of robber barons are really getting away with it is when they start posting dick pics after cutting people off healthcare.
Most vulnerable he's ever been.
Yeah, I'm so vulnerable. Yeah. almost as vulnerable as people who just got, you know, thrown off healthcare. I hope there's no like treatments that they're on. Like that's a little bit vulnerable too. But David and I actually years ago, David was on came on my other podcast, which is in a bit of a hiatus now, Literary Hangover, and we talked about an essay by Oscar Wilde, The Soul of Man Under Socialism. Sometimes it's just censored to The Soul of Man, but true heads know it's The Soul of Man Under Socialism. And he has this part in it. The possession of private property is very often extremely demoralizing. And that is, of course, one reason why socialism wants to get rid of the institution. In fact, property is really a nuisance. Some years ago, people went on about the country saying that property has duties. They said it often and so tediously that at last the church has begun to say it. One hears it now from every pulpit. It is perfectly true. Property not merely has duties, but so many duties that its possessions to any large extent are a bore. It involves endless claims upon one, endless attention to business, endless bother. If property had simply pleasures, we could stand it, but its duties make it unbearable. And it's a little bit of Oscar Wilde irony. It said, in the interest of the rich, we must get rid of private property. But the thing about that guy, he's trying to do PR for him, property or these business owners as a class of people, right? And look, you might feel bad about firing somebody. Like that probably does suck to you on an interpersonal level, but you have to understand that you as a class of people are the ones that make this so hard, right? We could very easily have extended health insurance. Like one of the main things that sucks about losing a job is where are you gonna live, and what are you gonna do if you're sick, and just to name two. And there's not a class of people more against extending that to the average working person or or people as just citizens of a country, or people as just humans, than is the type of people he's trying to say aren't all of these bad guys, and here is me crying after I just did actually something that's pretty traumatic. like that is a huge decision that you are trusted with, and you decided that, yeah, these people have to go fend for themselves in a system that is just entrenched to make it as hard as possible.
And he said it was because he made a stupid decision. And I know that his employees know that. They watched
him do
it.
You know what the stupid decision was? He knocked up a prostitute.
He actually has a girlfriend. Hello.
And that's why he had to pay hush money.
Well,
girlfriend/partner. And so two persons were laid off. He could only bring himself to lay off one, and she had to lay off the other one.
Yeah, she's still on the payroll.
Did he talk to her like a pimp? Do you really love me, honey? You know what we have?
Hey. I'll see that selfie. I want to see the selfie after he fires and breaks up with his girlfriend. Like, that would be a selfie, a crying selfie that would be funny to watch. But she's kept on to do the George Clooney up in the air sort of. Let's talk about your options and how this might be an opportunity for you.
I mean, the whole thing is extremely hilarious. What I saw, I saw it before you sent it, man. I saw something in Vice about it. And I couldn't stop laughing actually when I saw it, because I you know, of course they care to a certain extent, but it's like watching a show like The Office. Like, how much do you think, you know, Michael Scott's character really cares about his employees when he's constantly undermining them and being severely racist to them? It's like, you know, he cares about not being looked at as important. So, you know, do I think Mark Zuckerberg cares to a certain extent? I don't know, maybe. Sure. Does he stop doing what he's gonna do? No. He's still gonna have he's gonna have a barbecue in his estate and just be like, man, sorry, I had to lay off like 5,000 people today. Meat's gonna not taste the same.
Wasn't that something that happened at WeWork too, where like they laid off like 500 employees?
Yeah.
And who was the band that played? They had like a big name act come and play, and they had like, you know, waitresses and like bikinis handing out tequila shots, and they're like, by the way, we're like firing the entire accounting section or whatever.
WeWork was such a fun that's another interesting documentary. You know, while these documentaries will never say like the reason why is capitalism, they are a great insight into the charade. You know, when we talk about terms like grifter, like, please don't use that for podcaster Joe, because the WeWork guy is a grifter. Like that dude. Elizabeth Holmes. Grifter. Grifter. Grifter.
I don't know if you guys saw this. This was actually earlier this summer, New York Post. Winklevoss twins sing Don't Stop Believing days after layoffs at crypto startups.
So my gosh.
Wow.
Those are the Facebook guys, right?
Yeah, oh, here.
Yeah.
Don't play it. Don't play it.
Oh yeah.
No, I'm not even kidding. I'm sorry. Like literally last time we did it, we got a copyright strike.
Yeah, you get a copyright strike on it. Yeah, you get 10 seconds. So you get 10 seconds of play time.
Well, I think
sorry, not to be.
But that was really they were really go, with Journey,
that
though,
shitty
right?
ass cover somehow gets picked up in their algorithms. By the way, is amazing to me. But yeah, we got like Universal or whatever copyright strike, which is a pain in the ass to deal with.
It is, yes.
Yeah. I don't think that was with actual Journey. No, I think that's just the Winklevoss twins band.
So. You know, I tried to when I said that it was us, Matt. I said it was us doing a cover of an original song to try to get rid of the strike, and they didn't give it to us.
Oh, just say you were using his commentary. That shit. Because those guys got some ridiculous amount of money in their settlement with Facebook.
Yeah.
And they were already ridiculous. So they had like legacy money to begin with. And then they got some sort of dumb, was it like $500 million payout or some crazy shit like that? Like they have crazy fuck you money.
Yeah. And imagine like doing that, and like a big part of what you spend your life doing is some bullshit crypto thing.
Like all you know how to do is just keep making fuck you money off poor people.
The dumbest people. Like, yeah, exactly. Like, no productive ideas. Just like, let's see how we can like scam folks or get easy cash. I mean, you wonder why America's in such trouble. Grifters.
I want to start using the term for the right people. Grifter. There can be stupid people without you thinking they're con men. Let's just call them stupid. Like that guy's fucking stupid. Me and Toussaint had this. You know why, Matt? Me and Toussaint had this phone call earlier today, and I was bitching it in her ear. I've spent many a night bitching in Pascal's ear about this. I wrote a whole thing about it. it's one of the things that really gets under my skin. The whole like, hey, sometimes motherfuckers are just dumb. Like, don't think they're that much smarter that they're going, what I'm gonna do is. Check this out. I'm going to talk about forcing a vote, and then I'm going to get all these assholes to follow me.
Yeah, because often it's not true. Like, you actually look at, like, like that doesn't work. If they were purely motivated by, like, the numbers, especially force a vote, like, there's a reason certain members of that started talking about like ivermectin and shit.
You want to see the you know what the grift is? When me and Pascal go to the Manosphere.
Oh yeah,
that's the grift. When I'm just like,
I'm ready for
that. Toussaint, can you just shut up and make a sandwich?
I'll make it and eat it.
Yeah, you guys can be the new Andrew Tates.
Oh, like that Andrew Tate guy?
Yeah,
I'm working out every day so I can start doing topless shows like Andrew Tate.
David and I, we have a Left Reckoning TikTok, and we posted one with a Matt Crisman talking about Jordan Peterson, and I did hashtag it Men of TikTok and hashtag Mentor. So
I love that.
That Andrew Tate guy, I've didn't know who he was, and I watched something about him. What's the guy's name? Hassan.
Yeah, you gotta watch Hassan thing.
The Hassan did something against the Andrew Tate guy. Yeah. I was like, who the fuck is this guy? And why does anybody take him seriously? He's not wearing a shirt, and he's got like everything he's doing right now is silly. Yeah. And they said he makes so many millions of dollars a month with some fake university.
Yeah.
These guys are all awesome. Like, there's that guy Gary V.
There's
Gary another Southern Vee. Boy that I don't know his name, but he's another one, and they, you know, it's Matt all Cardone? Basically like, yeah, that guy. Crank I don't even Cardone. Know if he's Southern. I'm assuming, I guess, but
right.
But their, you know, their whole thing is like, if you buy a house, then you can rent it and you can make more money off. Like, it's just like absolutely psycho stuff. But what I love the most is that, like, you know, because the grift doesn't just stop at like giving people like bad financial advice. It has to go into personal stuff. And there's a video of like Gary Vee saying, I don't spit out gum. I swallow it because for me, like, the value of my time is so high that the time it takes to spit it out and put it in the trash can is, it's too much of a loss. So I swallow the gum. And it's like, bro, you can't be putting this kind of shit out there and people gobble it up. It's so bizarre. It's, but I'm, at the same time, I will admit I'm glued to it. I love it. It's so fascinating for me to watch this shit.
Wait a minute.
Did you?
He said he swallows gum.
Yeah.
Did you see the thing he said about his family?
No, what did he say about his family?
He swallows gum.
He swallows
because
gum
of efficiency. And
in order to stay motivated, he imagines that his family has been murdered.
Jesus Christ.
To keep him going.
Gum?
And
no one, not one person thought to stand up and be like, "Hey, man, that seems dangerous."
Maybe don't do that.
Not one person thought to say that doesn't sound like a good idea, Gary.
I mean, that's a good context when they say, like, I only sleep 3 hours. It's like, well, probably because your stomach is just like tossing and turning all night long.
Like, have you ever heard? Like, I will tell. Here's a true story about motivation. True story. There's a motivational video. I'm not gonna lie, it does get me kind of pumped up sometimes. this is black dude doing a workout, and while he's doing the workout, there's a motivational speaker speaking in the background over like explosions in the sky music. Those are some Texas boys for you there, David.
There you go.
Plano, I believe they're from. Anyway, this dude is doing this crazy ass workout, and the guy's talking about motivation the whole time. He's like, when Beyonce did her record, she was so dehydrated from not sleeping. I'm like, you sure it wasn't cocaine? Like, I've been around musicians. And when you're not sleeping, generally, it's cocaine. But I recorded an album in a day. Or no, like 48 hours. I didn't leave my apartment for 2 weeks. That was depression. That was not motivation. Depression. I was mentally in a bad place. And I needed someone to open the door and hug me.
Aww.
That was just depression.
Was it David Goggins?
Is that the David motivational Goggins? Speaker? I don't know the
guys.
It's a great video if you want to like if you have a problem like working out, like, oh, I never get motivated to work out. You watch this dude. I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I got to do this. But as far as like this idea that is what like the 10,000 hours. We were talking about this recently, Pascal, with what's the guy's name that you can't stand?
Gladwell.
Oh, you talk about Malcolm Gladwell.
Gladwell. Yeah. That whole 10,000 hour shit. Like, I would meet so many musicians. I'd be like, oh, got to get my 10,000 hours in. Got to get my 10,000 hours in.
Ooh.
Like, you know how many years that is? Like, you got to – you can't – bruh.
The whole thing, all that stuff is all designed to divorce the role of political economy and actually legacy wealth from shaping what actually you have to work with as a human being. So that you can always say, well, yeah, you didn't try hard enough. Just because, you know, even though everyone else you're competing with has 5 trust funds. You know, it's ridiculous. You know, it's really
all I got was a small loan from my dad of $1 million.
Like whatever, you know, you're coming from the music world, you always assume that, you know, someone worked really hard and they did all this to get famous. And then you start meeting them or reading their stories and like, especially with Guns N' Roses, you know, Slash says, oh, you know, I invited David Geffen over the house because my mom knew him. And we played our demo. They toured in a van for help? No, not at all. It's foolish. Like, do you know how many people you see on TV that are related to people in TV? Mm-hmm. It's foolish. Foolish to think it's just hard work. It's just hard work to work real hard. 10,000 hours.
It's getting worse, too.
Maritime oh, my season. God. We talk about this with sports all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Who's dominating in sports? light-skinned kids of professional athletes.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. Like, especially like certain sports, like soccer is one of those sports where like being rich like opens up so many damn doors for you, like crazy doors for you. And a lot of those guys, it's like, oh, it's so wonderful that this son of a very famous soccer player is on the team, mm-hmm. continuing the legacy. It's like, just, well, I don't know. He's like, knows everybody, him? Man.
No. Please don't think that. Okay, I want to keep you guys for 3 more minutes. Thank you so much for coming on, and thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. This is going bi-monthly affair. Again, if you haven't done it already, please hit the like button on both channels. As a matter of fact, stop watching it here. Go hit like there and vice versa. It helps us in the YouTube algorithm. Also hit subscribe. Not only does it help in the algorithm, it helps my confidence. That's really what it's about. I have low self-esteem. When I see the numbers go up, I feel a little bit better. The cutting stops.
Jason does not have low self-esteem.
Look there's at a, there's a woman in this room, Pascal, that just said, yes, he does.
She might say you have a little something else, but not a little something
else. Wow. Wow. You are not supposed to yell out how low my testosterone levels are. But if Nutrigenix, whatever that's called, wants to sponsor This Is Revolution, we're more than happy to shill your dick pills for money.
Athletic Green.
We'll shill dick pills. # We'll shill your dick pills. There's nothing wrong with that, is there?
I just hope that you can keep that smile on and we just look at that for the next 2 minutes. Dick pills.
Are you a leftist that suffers from erectile dysfunction?
Sounds like whole sex of the left, man.
Want us to pump up that hammer? Leftist dick pills.
He was a blue chew.
Yeah, exactly. They're on podcasts.
Look again. If Jesus is real, when I get that email from those Frank Thomas, go in there and shill dick pills all day. I would like to share one news story of my own before we go. It was reported recently in the Los Angeles Times that residents in L.A. will vote in 2024 on a program to provide temporary housing for homeless Angelenos by allowing them to obtain vouchers to stay in vacant hotel rooms. Have you guys heard this at all?
Only from you sharing that article.
The Hotel Workers Union and several other organizations fighting for the unhoused in Los Angeles support the initiative. Obviously, hotel owners oppose this measure as they fear it will negatively affect their business. California's Project Room Key is coming to an end, as well as its voluntary participation model. Under this new measure, hotels will be required to provide a daily listing of vacant rooms and would not be allowed to refuse homeless individuals. Hotel owners are frightened because they feel the way the bill is structured now, it wouldn't provide them any extra security or on-site staff that would assist with mental health crisis breakdowns or housing navigators that could help people find long-term housing solutions. As I have said on this show numerous times, homelessness is not a monolithic issue. There are many factors at play. Who would be eligible for such a program? What would be the impact on unhoused families? Would people that live in cars be eliminated from this? Mm. Well, you know, one of the things that I don't think we talk about enough is that to be homeless in a lot of municipalities, there's a series of questions you have to answer to even deemed homeless. And one of them, sometimes if you live in a car or an RV, you don't qualify for certain kinds of housing. Which policies would this program have for people with violent pasts, sex offenders, arsonists? The hotel I worked in, within a week, it caught on fire because there was an arsonist inside that everyone knew was an arsonist. And no one thought it was a bad idea to have him sequestered in another building off on his own. The idea that the average hotel owner could afford such a level of staffing and that random travelers would want to vacation in that kind of situation seems outlandish. In addition, why is Airbnb not included in the discussion? Due to the fact that a large amount of their properties are multifamily residences, they have a great deal of vacant space that could be used for housing longer-term families. The problem I have with a program like this is that it could be destined to fail. When a crime occurs or violence occurs, it would resonate nationally and kill the idea of integrating the unhoused with a housed population in a situation when you're unable to provide wraparound services. It is imperative that we cease to view homelessness as a problem confined to large cities and one that requires federal attention. Millions of people could be housed and employed under this massive public works project. Imagine if we looked at taking on homelessness from a federal standpoint and really wanted to make it a real jobs program instead of constantly looking at it as the responsibility of the states
who are bankrupt.
Trying to cut that budget as much as they can, dole it out to a nonprofit organization that's also going to try to cut that budget as much as they can. And you keep having the same problem over and over and over and over again. You're kind of uplifting the same capitalist paradigm of landlords and renters. It almost seems like we just want nicer, more humane landlords. Really what we're trying to get here, at best. Hotels, I do think, are part of a solution to homelessness. But my big fear is that, much like Vancouver, Canada, where a lot of their safe injection sites are located in one area, you kind of create these little hell zones of poverty and despair. And that's probably what you're going to see happen with this hotel initiative. I mean, can you really imagine homeless people staying in the Four Seasons if they have a vacancy? In the Fairmont, if there's a vacancy? I mean, let's be realistic with this. This would be sequestered to one area of town. You know, Oakland is a prime example of what this looks like, where many of the hotels were in one area that had pretty much been decimated by the teams leaving, where the Oakland Coliseum is. When the Raiders left, when the Warriors left, they left a huge vacant hole. Walmart then left. Actually, Walmart left before they left. So there's just vacant space. And now this whole area that historically was just a neighborhood is tent cities. There's a reason why the A's can't get people to come to the game, because you can't avoid walking through the tent city just to get to the game. And when you look at, again, the hotels that they had regulated for, that the county had bought for the unhoused, that's where they all were. That whole area also is where a housing project is as well in Oakland. So there's a main thoroughfare that runs there, and it's almost like the other side of the thoroughfare is where we're going to keep the good citizens, and we're going to over-police anyone that crosses this line. And with underneath that line, we don't care what you people do. You guys have anything, any opinions on that before we go?
I mean, great way to bum me out.
For real, right?
I mean, I support, like, here in Austin, you know, a lot of the campaigns have been, I mean, trying to be multifaceted, but, like, I totally agree that, like, we need a federal solution to this crisis, because it's like there's not one city in the damn country that's not dealing with this. And, you know, the question is, like, how humane is their city going to be? And it's up and down. Like, for a while here, camping was legalized, and then there was this horrible, like, right-wing reaction against it, and they put some of the harshest anti-camping bans on the books. In Nashville, it's a felony now to camp. You know, so that's a side of it. But, like, just making camping legal or illegal is, like, not even beginning to address the problem. Like, you need to have a federal program, and the reason for that is because city and state governments are very much underfunded. They don't have the Federal Reserve. to back them up, to make the kind of purchases and investment that's necessary. I totally agree that, like, sometimes, like, totally, like, fight on your local level to get things. Like, I support, for example, like, they've been buying underperforming hotels around town mm-hmm. in Austin and using that as housing. It's there. It's ready to go. Boom. I think that that's helpful, but that can't be the end, you know? And, like, that's, like, the two-faceted part of finding a solution. This is, like, end criminalization and, like, the abuse that people are facing. Mm-hmm. Find people a place that they can stay tonight. But the long term, like, we have to be building homes and providing them to people as soon as possible. And the only institution that can do that is the federal government. Like, I'm sorry, it doesn't matter how rich your state is. They just they are strapped, unfortunately. And that's on purpose, too, by the way.
I mean, I was just interested that the hotel workers themselves support it, because those would be the first people I would look to for the concerns about the safety.
You know why?
Yeah, tell me.
Because they were unhoused themselves during the pandemic.
Well, there
so
you go.
A lot of people that worked in hotels had to stay in hotels. There's levels to homelessness, and I think when most people, especially on the left, and this is one of my big gripes with other workers that come from that same world of working with the unhoused and people in addiction services, is that we look at it as a monolithic problem, and we flatten homelessness to just people that were living in their car and that can function. And you forget that there's more people that aren't in houses that can't function alone, so you can't just put them in a house. And you have to look at this like, okay, there's a bunch of people that, because they function also, they don't get those services first. So a lot of the places that you see that house people, you have to take the ones that can't function first and then figure out, you know, what services they need and, you know, yada, yada, yada. That's why there's always so many problems. So, you know, someone's talking about San Diego being one of the best places to be homeless. By the way, I just drove there the other day just to mail something. That's where my post office box is. And so many people were sleeping in their car at the McDonald's parking lot.
Can I also just say, like, I don't think the people watching this or the chat needs to hear this, but, like, one thing that's also really frustrating is, like, you get these, like, kind of right-wingers, bootstrap folks, and they're like, we're making it too easy if we put people in hotels or whatever. And I'll just tell you this, like, I know I'm not alone in this experience, but, like, you know, we experienced homelessness when I was growing up. And we stayed in a hotel for a prolonged period of time. Gratis, I don't know what the circumstances there were. But anyways, you know, we were in there. Not a nice place to be for a prolonged period of time. Like, that's not a home in any kind of, like, real functional imagining of what a home should be. So, again, I don't think our chatter audience needs to hear that. But it does sort of, like, make my blood boil when I hear these, like, right-wing bubbas going on about, oh, we're giving these guys, like, towels and a shower and, like, life of luxury. It's like, no, man, like, that's a small room that you're sort of stuck in because you can't get a job because you don't have an address, all that kind of stuff.
You have to be prepared you have to be prepared to deal with the right-wing reaction. And I'll leave you guys with this. When I was at the hotels, Tucker Carlson, I did a whole thing just ripping on the hotels because they gave alcohol to people in one of the COVID hotels we had. They were literally talking about one of the hotels that we had that was next door to the one I was in. And, mm-hmm. and the COVID hotels were people that were COVID positive, and they stayed in their room for 23 hours a day. They had 3 20-minute breaks. They were allowed to smoke in their room. They were given cigarettes if they ran out. And they were giving little shot glasses of alcohol. I think they could have 3 or 4 a day was like the max, whatever. And Tucker Carlson got on air and said, we are paying for alcoholics to stay alcoholics. We are paying for drug addicts to stay drug addicts. This isn't, you know, where taxpayer money should go. California should be upset, blah, blah, blah. There was one of the guys on the maintenance staff that was a huge Tucker Carlson fan that literally played this in front of me. And I will never forget this day. I stopped him and I said, how much is the budget? Because he knew this for water. No, I said, how much is the budget for alcohol? He said, I know how much it is. How much is it? He goes, we spend $2,000 a month. How much do you spend on water? Is it more than $2,000 a month? He goes, oh, yeah, it's like 5 times that. So do you really think we're funding alcoholism? How drunk can you really get? Of 3 shot glasses a day. Have you ever seen a person going through alcohol withdrawal? Generally, they shit all over the walls. As someone that has seen someone go through alcohol withdrawal in North Dakota, Matt State, they shit all over the walls. It's uncontrollable. And that's if you're lucky. So I'd rather not have people dying from withdrawal, A. And B, you're not really spending that much money on this alcohol when you look at it from the perspective of keeping people drunk. It's not like you're ordering up shots all the time and literally giving them crack. Keeping people alive, harm reduction is actually extremely important.
Same page, friend.
Thank you, guys, for hanging out with us.
It's always great hanging out with all of y'all. I really appreciate hanging out with you, Jason, Pascal, and Empty Sant. Thanks so much. Really, it's a pleasure. I'm excited to be doing this on the regular, y'all.
And I have some things to discuss with you guys. Hopefully, was it tomorrow we're talking?
Whenever Matt decides.
Okay.
Oh, it's on me?
Yeah, you are the decider. Probably tomorrow. Probably so tomorrow. We'll have some more really good news coming up. I'm pretty excited about the news I've heard so far. Jay Zacharias, this is for you. You'd be surprised how many people love the crack.
Was it really for him or what for you?
Well, Toussaint, I have a whole other soundboard for you in the next hour, so don't you worry.
Okay.
And on that note, Pascal,
we are out.